Welcome to the Netcast. This is James McElhinney. Elise Engler keeps track of the world through her drawings, paintings, and accordion books, making lists and documenting her travels to the Galapagos, Antarctica, Sicily, and the streets of New York. Beginning on May 19, 2014, Elise Engler spent a year on Broadway, exploring it block by block, from Kingsbridge to the Battery. Engler recently completed a residency at the McDowell Colony, and last year she began working on a series entitled First Radio Headline Heard of the Day, a chronicle of mostly political events as they unfold in real time. I recently caught up with Elise Engler to learn more about her work. We're talking today with Elise Engler. Good morning.
Good morning.
I was wondering if you could unpack the story about how you got involved in painting and books.
I've always kept small journals. The way when I traveled, I always had a book that was small enough that could fit in anything I was carrying at the time. So that's one way. And my first trip where I really kept that kind of drawn journal was when I was 22 and went to Alaska and couldn't carry much because we were backpacking and had to carry months' worth of food. So a little book was the perfect way to chronicle the experience. So that's the first time, and I've kept a small book of my drawings whenever I've traveled since then, which is getting to be close to 40 years.
You're speaking about drawings, but in fact, a lot of what you do now is to produce paintings in that format. Were you producing paintings at that time, or?
Yes, and I kind of use the word drawing and painting interchangeably because these days there is a kind of very confusing borderline between a drawing and a painting, and people start calling anything that's on paper a drawing. So even though in fact, it's a painting. People associate painting with canvas and oil and scale. And so they, and maybe because my painting is very much about drawing, I kind of vacillate between those two words.
Rico Lebrun once said that people without anything to say gossip, people without anything to draw sketch. So there's a distinction between what is a sketch and what is a drawing. How do you define that?
No, I think I don't denigrate the idea of a sketch. To me, a sketch is a thought. A sketch is something I do to record something kind of quickly, but I don't denigrate it. It's just it doesn't have maybe the time element or the permanence, but it's not any less important than anything or any more important than anything else. It's just sketches, maybe just something fast and mm-hmm. immediate.
Mm-hmm. What I'm trying to get at is that there is, as you alluded to before, a presumption that certain media and certain scale is superior.
Well, that's a marketplace consideration, right? All that kind of hierarchy. It was looking at the drawings of Øyvind Fahlström. Mm-hmm. At seeing in 1996 two of his drawings in the recent acquisition show at MoMA that made me realize that a drawing could have as much power as any painting, and it liberated me tremendously because at that point I was making really big paintings and they were okay. I mean, but all of a sudden I thought, I don't have to make big paintings. Actually, I didn't think that. I thought, I'm going to start this drawing project and we'll see where it goes. And the more I did it, the more I realized that I was liberated from feeling the compulsion to have to make big, important paintings, and that I could work on paper and I could draw and that could say what I needed to say.
Well, at the time that you had that epiphany, what was your relationship to the market? Were you exhibiting in a gallery?
No. Not really. I was exhibiting here and there, but not very much. I was a rather late bloomer as far as the exhibition world. An early bloomer as far as making art, but I didn't really get myself involved in that world. I always just made work.
Well, de Kooning didn't have a solo exhibition, I think, until he was in his 40s. I think there's a lot of pressure today for people to come right out of graduate school and emerge as some kind of superstar.
I never heard the word career. I never knew that that existed. The career as artist, it didn't occur to me. I just like to make art. And it was a kind of naivete on my part, in fact, because I live right in New York City. It's not like I was in the hinterlands and didn't know about it all. It just wasn't my concern, partly naive and partly... And there, you know, there's some young people who come out of art school who are doing fabulous stuff. So I don't want to judge them on my own experience, which... But it took me a long time to know what I wanted to do. And I think it's part because of my art education, which divided. And in part, I blame myself because I didn't know better. But also, I look at my art education, which divided how and why. And they never were considered at the same time. So I went to the Art Students League, and I really learned how to draw. You know, I had a great classical drawing education, but I came out of there thinking, now what do I do? Because my intellectual self wasn't ever brought into that kind of education. It was all about a kind of skill and technique,
Right. Which
I say is my own foolishness in a way that I didn't know that, but I was young and I was trying to figure things out, and it took me a long time to put those why and hows together.
So you didn't have any studio classes in college?
I didn't go to college until I finished high school by the time I was 16.
Mm-hmm.
I finished high school in the early 70s when people's faith in institutions was rather low, including mine. Even though I was a daughter of a college professor, I didn't want to be anywhere near college. I didn't like school. I didn't like high school. I liked learning. I liked reading. I liked everything attached to what school should be. But the actual institution of school had been a pretty dreadful experience for me. So the thought of going to college, even though I had a very admired father as a college professor, was just the furthest thing from my mind. So I went and I took classes and I worked and I supported myself. And then I realized that my brain wasn't really engaged. So I went back to school for literature. And I just took lots of literature classes and read and read and read and ultimately backed my way into the art studios at Hunter College. So that's when I started putting together that there was a how and a why. And even though I didn't know that's what was going on until I look at that with retrospect. But it took me a long time to figure things out because so much of everything seemed to be rather compartmentalized.
So when you were going to Hunter?
Yes.
Studying lit?
Yes. Philosophy and history and all those things.
So a classic liberal arts education with an emphasis on literature.
Yes.
And was it then your ambition to write?
Or? No, I was still making art. I just needed some other kind of stimulus. And I also, you know, I mean, I was sort of 20-something years old, and all of a sudden to come out of art school, a kind of the technique-oriented art school, and sort of proclaim oneself an artist and then go, now what? You know, I really didn't know. So I needed to know more, you know, I think ultimately more about myself, but also about the world.
So there was no preparation to start exhibiting. Like everybody at that point in time, you remember Tom Wolfe's book, The Painted Word,
sure.
Which actually all came true, with people flooding into the city and moving into lofts and attempting to paint sort of the next great thing to get acclaim, money, and a career.
No, I was very naive, but I went off to Bennington College, and then I was thrown into that world because, of course, a lot of the people I went to school with were ultimately quite successful, and I had to catch up.
That would be, I think, a lot of people at the time would have said, a kind of alternative model of higher education, sort of like Hampshire College or...
Bennington,
but like Hampshire is a bit like that as well. I think people who came out of there were Ken Burns and many others.
I mean, Bennington was very good for me because when I was... I got a full fellowship, so I was actually able to make art all the time, which I couldn't do when I was at Hunter because I worked. I went to school mainly at night. I was working. I was supporting myself. I was so going to Bennington, all of a sudden I was had a great studio. I had people around me who were interesting and I could work all the time and started making work that it's very different than what I do now. But I went through there's still something there that influenced me.
Who were your teachers?
Rochelle Feinstein, mm-hmm. Philip Wofford, mm-hmm. Pat Adams was there, although Pat Adams and I didn't always see eye to eye.
One must have that kind of relationship as well. It's good.
Her adversity, yes, it was actually really, it was very motivating because I actually went through, it was a very difficult time. Within a month of my getting there, my mother was diagnosed with cancer and I had to leave. So I came back to New York and spent time with my mother till she died. So I went back to Bennington and I had to kind of like find my footing again. And also I had lots of other stuff going on at that time, personal sort of crises. So it was it was a tough time. So I had my footing in the world was very precarious at that point. And so Pat Adams came into my studio and told me what to do. And it was so far from anything that I was interested in. I still remember her. I want you to make a painting with a triangle, a circle, and a square. And I thought, why? I don't want to make paintings with triangles, circles, and squares. So she came in 3 weeks ago in a row and asked me, like, where my triangle, circles, and squares were. And I finally said to her, Pat, you know, I'm never going to make a painting with triangles, circles, and squares. It's just not what I do. So she kind of got very upset with me and left my studio in a huff, leaving her pocketbook behind, which I was such a brat that I didn't bring to her, so she had to come back and get it.
Oh, dear.
Horrible, horrible late 20-year-old that I was. But anyway, I was so angry at that point that somebody wanted me to paint like them than me that I thought I'm going to paint like me as much as possible, which forced me to paint like me, which at that time became very, very thick expressionistic oil paintings. I took the landscape and I just painted the hell out of it. And I still like those paintings, even though they have, they're so far from what I do now, but they got me somewhere. And that anger was quite motivating. And also, it was interesting because they were intense. I mean, when I had my thesis show there, I got mail from somebody who said that I painted like the devil.
Who would say a thing like that?
Some crazy person who lived in the town of Bennington, because my paintings were on the front page of the Bennington Banner.
I see. It's not the kind of place where you expect to find some kind of rattlesnake fondling fundamentalist.
Yeah, it was quite startling.
Christian church. No.
It was startling, but it was interesting.
Well, at least you got a strong response.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
So landscape, the first works of yours that I saw were at the Dorsky Curatorial Projects, where you were speaking, you were in an exhibition, and you had an accordion book that you had created from your trip to the Antarctica. So perhaps you could tell us how you got from thickly painted expressionist Vermont landscapes to very intimate watercolor paintings of the Antarctica. What was the evolution?
So I think the thread that runs through the work, even at Bennington that late, those thick paintings, was a documentary aspect. So maybe in Vermont, I was documenting my relationship to myself and that landscape. And then from there, I started making small drawings of objects. I mean, this is much, much later. I'm sort of skipping a lot of time in the mm-hmm. middle there. But so I started making these list drawings that documented everything in this apartment, everything I owned. So my scale became much more intimate. in terms of the depictions. And that intimacy of scale, I think, sent me back to these books, which, although I've kept them consistently, that they became, instead of just a journal, which I don't mean to minimize them, but that was their function, was mm-hmm. a kind of journalistic with text and image, to making small work that was documenting my landscape in the Antarctic. And also there was a sort of conceptual element to it, which was in those Antarctic books, they were the view out of windows. So there were two of them that I did there. One was the view out of every single window in a small field camp, which had numerous buildings, or a limited number of buildings, actually. And then, so I did every window in that small field camp. And then in McMurdo Station, which is tremendous, I did one window view out of almost every building. So I think it was about the scale and about documenting.
So did you come to Antarctica via air or by sea?
Air. Because I went from the New Zealand side, so you fly.
Right. Would you have any interest in returning by sea?
I'd go back by rollerblade if I could.
So what was the enchantment there for you?
It's so otherworldly. The light is spectacular. I mean, there's a crystalline quality to the light that I've never seen anywhere else. It's also the sort of the level of involvement that everybody had with being there. So much of one's existence is about the fact that you're there. So to have all of these people reflecting on this common theme, your location is the primary binding element and topic of conversation. And the people were so interesting because they were all there for various reasons. So that's kind of the social kind of atmosphere. But then in terms of what it looks like, I mean, it just looks like nowhere else on Earth. There's this, depending on where you are, if you're by the sea, the color of the ice, I mean, it's absolutely turquoise. It's uncanny. Mm-hmm. If you're in the interior, there's this, you know, flat white quality, and then the sky, and then the light is, I mean, it's 24 hours worth of light, which can be rather daunting. And you think, for me, because I like to work in daylight and I love daylight, no matter what I'm drawing, I use natural light as much as possible. I'd wake up in the middle of the night and think, it's light, I should be working. And then I'd remember it was the middle of the night. So,
were you able to get to most of the different parts of Antarctica?
Well, Antarctica is the size of the U.S. and Canada. But I was able to travel more than many people because my proposal, which is initially was to go to the teeny, teeny research station called Palmer Station, but that only accommodates 44 people or so. So there was no room for me. So I had the advantage of being knocked off my proposal, which meant that I didn't have one, which meant that I had a lot of freedom in a certain way. I didn't have people there talked about proposal drift, but since my proposal had to change, and since it was titled Unpacking Antarctica, which gave me a lot of latitude, and they were very gracious to me there and allowed me to go to the South Pole, which was very unusual. Usually you have to have that in your initial proposal. But because my work was very much in sync with the philosophy of the National Science Foundation's proposal that it was about educating people about what happened in Antarctica, mm-hmm. and that was clearly what the work did, they were generous, and I was able to go to the South Pole.
Going back to your list paintings, I remember when I saw those, I was reminded of sort of expeditionary reports, you know, people who were collecting biological specimens or ornithological specimens or fossils or whatever. It had some of the quality of that kind of expeditionary art of the 18th and 19th century, mm-hmm. especially under the influence of Humboldt and that nexus of art and science.
Darwin's drawings.
Humboldt's modest attempts and that he had elaborated after the fact when he got back to Europe. How involved were you in researching scientifically generated art or scientifically purposed art?
Not very. Sort of more incidentally. You know, I'd see it, but I can't say that I spent a huge amount of time researching it. It's sort of on my bucket list of things to do.
But the aesthetic appealed to you?
I like the aesthetic, but I also like the aesthetic of artists who work like that. And maybe I saw them before I saw or was a really conscious. I mean, going back to Øyvind Fahlstrøm or somebody like Mark Lombardi. So these are people who took sort of systematic kind of work and made it into something aesthetic as well as informative. And I like that kind of aesthetic.
Might you reach a little further into the past and have a look at people like William Hodges or George Catlin or Audubon?
Yeah, oh, sure. Absolutely.
So this is a tradition of painting that many painters don't identify with. Mm-hmm. They see that as a form of illustration because it's in the service of other goals other than, you know, the realization of one's personal vision.
Well, that whole word illustration is sort of, I'm not sure how to deal with it because somebody the other day said to me, well, yeah, I know your work. You're kind of an illustrator. And I said, well, I'm not sure what that means.
Yeah, it's very 20th century.
That's what I said. That's what exactly, I didn't say that, but what I said was, you know, I'm very grateful that these kind of delineations are breaking down because right. I do think of illustration as having a certain service quality that you are, that it's, that there's a text and then you are illustrating the text. And I like a certain parallel quality as opposed to, or sometimes even a not parallel quality. I'm working on a
resonant.
Yeah. And to have maybe the big picture, the big idea to be symbiotic, but not exactly one is in service of the other. Mm-hmm. Over the years, I've done a series of works that respond to poetry, which is like a whole other thing I do. And I just, having just come back from the McDowell Colony, there was a poet there whose work I liked very much, and we're working on something together now. And I'm trying to figure out, because her work is pretty abstract, and I'm not. My work is not particularly, whatever that word means, abstract. But I like when I am challenged with something that has a much more ephemeral language behind it, as opposed to, for example, what I'm doing right now, these headline pieces, which are not ephemeral. They're really very sort of concrete. So that poetry project brings out another aspect of making art. And we were talking about the difference between making illustrations of her poems, which I don't want to do. She has these images that occur, but I don't want to just do the images. I want to see if I can capture sort of what she's trying to say as opposed to her means of saying it.
Well, there were a lot of efforts in the early part of the 20th century by artists to work with musicians, with poets.
Right.
People like Kandinsky writing his book concerning the
right.
spiritual and art tries to articulate these parallels between circles, squares, and triangles, and colors,
right?
And Paul Klee, and I think about Sergei Eisenstein working with Prokofiev to create a synchronicity between the music and the film behind it, and at the same time, easel painters are scorning narrative painters whom they call illustrators because they happen to be working for the publishing industry. So you have people like N.C. Wyeth who had two styles. He had his Robert Louis Stevenson, you know, the Treasure Island style and, you know, the book style. And then he had, you know, the Delaware Valley Impressionist style. And he did two kind of schizophrenically.
Well, look what's happened to Norman Rockwell, who was sort of vilified for so long, and all of a sudden he's like Mr. Hot Man on the art market.
Well, yeah, because I think that that the art market has changed. The distinction between painting and illustration is not really important to anyone in the marketplace or even in the museum world. It seems to only exist in the art schools, and then I think only among artists of a certain age, advanced in years.
Or also there's a certain defensive quality, which, you know, that or distancing, like, oh, you do that. The person who said that to me, sort of, I was really surprised, actually, because I thought he'd be more sophisticated than that.
An illustrator is a sellout. He's painting for money. He or she is painting
for money. Or it's just not, you know, it's not imbued with a certain meaningfulness that, you know, it's not as, it's more superficial or...
Well, did you go to the Pier show over the weekend?
I took a break this year. I have gone many, many years. I just was not. I kind of think I should have gone to Works on Paper, but
I did. That was interesting.
Yeah, I should have gone to that.
That had a nice vibe.
Yeah, but you know, I do like going to the Pier show and going to the earlier one, not the, even though sometimes I see work in the big contemporary one I like, but because there's always that Marston Hartley that's come back on the market or the Mirandi right. that's come right. back on the market that you never will see again. So that's an advantage to going to that.
Right.
But, you know, I took a break. Since I've been back from McDowell, I've been kind of rather hermetic. So
I bring it up because one of the attractions was this big pink room that was put up by Jeffrey Deitch, and it was sort of a homage to Florine Stettheimer. There were a few of her pieces there surrounded by works by other artists that were sort of...
Oh, my God. I would like to have seen that.
In sympathy. But, you know, her work might have been called by some people illustrative.
Well, Andy Warhol called her a primitive. I love that. I just read that yesterday.
Like Grandma Moses or...
Yeah, he called her a primitive, and he talked about... Because I was showing my students the dollhouse.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a quote from Andy Warhol about, yeah... You know, by the way, Florian Stettheimer, who has been my muse for... Since I was, I don't know, a teenager. I discovered when... I have the MoMA catalog from 1940-something.
That's a collector's item.
Yeah, a friend gave that to me. It's one of my most incredible gifts ever.
Wow.
She and I have the same birthday, which was really kind of, I loved that.
So let's return to the idea of expeditionary art now.
Okay.
We've solved the problem of painting versus illustration, which I think we can agree is a...
It's very arbitrary.
It's a phenomenon of the last... century. It was because of the divergence of modern painting from figurative painting that was used in the publishing industry, either as the covers for the Saturday Evening Post or book plate illustrations. And so that whole competition that also was played out in the art schools between the painting departments and the illustration departments. And this doesn't really have any bearing on the world we now live in. I assume you agree.
Yeah.
At what point did you move away from the lists and start thinking about mobility and travel and narratives of exploration?
Well, those have always been there, no matter whether I was doing the lists or not. And the lists still reappear because they're part of my mobility, because whenever I travel, I make a drawing of the contents of my suitcase. Although I didn't do that to go to McDowell because I brought so much that I'd still be doing it now. But
so that goes back to your MFA days in Bennington.
The list drawings? Or
No. The narratives of travel and so intuitively.
They go back to Alaska and when I was 22.
Okay.
So that's like right from my sort of beginning as a semi-grown up artist.
So artistically, you keep cycling back to...
There's certain things that I do consistently. Right. Since 1978, I've kept little journals of trips that are text and have paintings in them. So there's piles of those. Mm-hmm. Since 1999, I started chronicling my suitcase. Although I have chronicles of things, list chronicles that I did when I was six, including a list of the clothing I wanted, drawn as little tiny list articles. So there's this funny thing, you go to art school and then you come back and you do what you do when you were six.
No, I think that's not an unusual story. I remember that Arthur Miller, when he was preparing to give his papers to University of Texas to, you know, the Ransom Library, came across what he thought was a misfiled manuscript for salesmen because it was in his college box.
Oh.
And it was in his college files. And then he read it and realized that he had tried to write the play when he was a junior in college and couldn't figure it out and filed it away. And then years later, it just reemerged as an idea, which he had forgotten entirely.
Well, it's like this thing about looking out of windows and making window images, mm-hmm. which is an old trope in art. I mean, we know there was a whole show at the Met about artists who look out windows. And
it was a wonderful show.
Oh, yeah, it was great.
Yeah.
But every time I do it, I think, I have an idea. I'm going to do a painting looking out. I mean, now I'm so aware of it that I'm not, but I did it about five times before I realized that I had done it four times previously.
So the Antarctica pictures were reassembled into the iteration that I saw at Dorsky, the sort of accordion book, or was that the way they were produced?
No, I did that on site like that, and I just carried that little book around, and those were done right there.
It's interesting. I think a lot of people associate that form with Asian books. Mm.
They were Asian books. That was a totally lucky thing that as I was packing my materials to go to the Antarctic, knowing that there's not an art supply store at McMurdo Station,
right.
I thought I'm going to bring everything I possibly can need, including way too much paper and way too much everything else. And as I was sort of finishing up packing, I remembered that I had bought those books in China in 1999. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, let me just throw in a couple of these. And that was why I had them. And I had I didn't know what I was going to do.
Well, you know, they're used in Japan as sort of temple passports.
Right. I found that out later. But
you would carry these around, and when you went to a temple, they would stamp. You would end up with a chop from each temple on a page. And so you could record your progress through these holy sites.
The thing about them, though, that I mean, it was the first time I have used them before, but I never used them quite. I've done sort of simple long drawings in them because I brought back a whole stack of them from China. I've used a few of them before that. But those were the most completed things I did in them. And then what that allowed me to, what I realized from that is that format of the accordion is great because it's endless.
Mm-hmm.
You can just keep gluing them together. And that's how the Broadway piece ended up being in that form, because I didn't have to decide how long it was going to be. It was additive.
You could just cut the cover off and...
Well, I just actually made...
Those you made yourself.
Those I made myself, and there's not a cover yet. Someday, hopefully there'll be a book published, but until then, it's just a long accordion drawing.
I wonder what ideas of travel resonate with you. We spoke about expeditions, and obviously going to someplace like Antarctica is expeditionary. What about pilgrimages? Just trying to make a connection between the format of the Japanese, you know, temple passport accordion book and the idea that this process of travel is also perhaps a process of pilgrimage or exploration or...
My most literal pilgrimage. I did do some of the Pilgrim's Walk in northern Spain, you know,
Santiago de Compostela.
Yeah. That's the most literal thing I've ever done, but I don't have much documentation of it. But putting that aside, I tend to be kind of hyper. So think about the way I work when I work in these books is they make me slow down and pay attention. And they also make me be very aware of where I am and of wanting to sort of bring wherever I am into my work. So I always figure out a way to notice the kind of detail of daily life, which is, I think, a lot of what my work is about anyway, whether it's the lists or these landscapes, is about saying, look what's here, and how does what's here reflect on sort of what's beyond, what's behind here.
So mode is self-positioning, being able to make sure that you're where you are because of how you're noticing and interacting with your surroundings.
As opposed to being distracted and elsewhere. And it's kind of, yeah, right. So that's something I'm very aware of as an artist and also as a kind of person who lives on the planet and who teaches and tries to get people to be aware of their daily life, their existence, what's around them, as a way of also being aware in the larger sense.
Well, it seems like a salubrious way to conduct yourself in an age that is afflicted with a kind of acquired media-enabled ADD.
I mean, all the secondary information coming through devices.
Well, we have our first tweet junkie president.
Yeah.
And I think he's not alone. There are a lot of people.
I'm a tweet junkie, too.
You are a tweet junkie.
Well, this particular project I'm working on now is very much connected to social media. So every single day when I draw the headlines, I tweet it and I put it on Instagram. So that's part of the project. So I've joined social media in a major way.
Well, let's talk a little about the Broadway project, because I found that really interesting and it resonated in a way with other artwork that had been done in the past about New York City, like Old New York by Eliza Pratt Greatorex and others who were involved with chronicling the life of the city and how it's transforming itself almost addictively. You know, New York will devour like one of its arms and sprout a bigger one. That's been called by a number of scholars the cannibal city because of how it's continually, you know, like a Ouroboros eating its own tail and then getting bigger and bigger and bigger in the process. And then also that route from King's Bridge to the Battery has the distinction of being the route that Washington rode when he went to meet his officers at Francis Tavern to bid them farewell. And so there's a lot, it's a storied thoroughfare. And of course it's a block away.
Yes.
Half a block away.
I could see it from my bedroom window.
So what was the genesis of that project and how did it evolve?
So a long time ago, I don't know how long, I had this idea about doing a project about Bedford Avenue in Brooklyn. That's where it started. It didn't start on Broadway.
Interesting.
And that may, in fact, be happening soon. We'll see. I'm waiting to hear. There might be a Bedford Avenue project.
Is there history there?
It's just that if you go on Bedford Avenue, it's the most extraordinary collection of different cultures as you drive down that avenue. You go from the, you know, Bed-Stuy and the Hasidic and the hipsters and then sort of beach culture. And you just drive and you see this kind of cross-section of a lot of New York identity. And so that's where it started. So I kept thinking I'm going to do... I'm not a filmmaker, although I've made a few little... I've made an animated movie and I've made a couple of little documentaries about the Antarctic, but, you know, very amateur. But I always thought I wanted to make a movie about Bedford Avenue. But I'm not a movie maker. I'm not a filmmaker. So I'm a drawer. So I thought, you know, someday I'm going to make a drawing about Bedford Avenue. And then I was sort of casually talking to a friend and I said, you know, I've been thinking about Bedford Avenue, but then I'm thinking, you know, Broadway is the street that I know. It's near me and it has, it's so iconic and it's so full of what we do know about New York and what we don't know about New York. It's got both of those elements and it's long and it's got history. And I can see it out my bedroom window. I think I'm going to do this Broadway project. And then I dropped it for a while. And this same friend said to me, whatever happened to your Broadway project? I thought that was such a great idea. And she sort of encouraged me to do it. And I said, all right, I'm going to do it. But I always start things never knowing if I'm going to finish them, although I generally do. But I start them kind of on a provisional basis. So I started drawing. And what I realized actually is that not only is my window overlooking Broadway, but it's roughly half a mile from the center of Broadway, or the middle of Broadway, Manhattan route. So I thought, and also for sort of economic, practical, and also artistic reasons, I thought sometimes I'm downtown and sometimes I'm uptown. I'm going to, instead of making this a straight drawing from top to bottom or bottom to top, I'm going to start at both ends and meet myself at my own window. And that's what I did. And I know it was partially also in response to the fact that I couldn't travel. I was in a horrific bicycle accident. And I think that if in retrospect, I look back and I think I also did this as a way to get myself on the street and to face traffic again, because I was kind of a nervous wreck even walking down the street on a sidewalk for at least a year after that accident. So just about 2 years later, I started this project.
So did the Broadway project actually begin? Was it conceived prior to your going to Antarctica?
No.
It was after.
It was way after, yeah.
Okay. It was the Bedford Avenue.
The Bedford Avenue idea goes back at least, but as this vague idea for a video or film, that probably goes back 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you began at opposite ends.
Yes.
And you worked your way towards the middle.
Yes.
Years ago, I met and had a lovely conversation with the late Shelby Foote, who everyone came to know through the Ken Burns film Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And I was painting battlefields in the South, and I was speaking with him about landscape and about terrain and about how people were shaped by their surroundings, how a lot of battles that were fought during, you know, the Civil War are now a stone's throw from interstate highways and so forth, and which is no coincidence. And he said something that really resonated with me. He said in his mellifluous Mississippi accent, he said, well, the one thing that I learned about the United States, especially the South, was I finally understood where all the rivers were and where all the mountain ranges were and how all the movement of people, how all that was possible and how it all fit together and how the land itself had an identity and how that influenced these events that he wrote about in his trilogy. So I was wondering if there was a parallel to that for you.
Maybe it reinforced the fact that we live in many cities, even though it's one city,
right,
and that the neighborhoods are so not as obviously different, perhaps, as Bedford Avenue, in that the communities are not as extreme as they might be on Bedford Avenue in Brooklyn. But if you're on 168th Street in Broadway, it's a very different city than if you're on 42nd Street in Broadway,
right,
which is obvious. I mean, I think I knew that before.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that was a revelation, but it was experiencing all of that was sort of affirmed that. And then what was interesting for me is, say, living in this neighborhood where I've lived on the Upper West Side, I've lived here for 40 years, and I've watched it go from being much more sort of edgy and dangerous and drug infested and but at the same time more mixed economically, and then being up in Inwood and feeling like that, and that's not a neighborhood I have spent a lot of time in, although in fact my aunts and uncles all lived in Inwood when I was a child, so I do have a kind of distant memory of spending time on 200th Street.
Clear division to the east of Broadway, you have, you know, the Dominican world, and to the west you have
Which is still this neighborhood somewhat, but not as extreme. And but so being in Inwood, and actually that's the neighborhood where people talk to me.
Wow. It's interesting because I think if you were to ask a lot of New Yorkers, where's Bloomingdale? They would tell you it's a department store.
Yeah.
They wouldn't tell you it's right down
108th
here.
Street.
108th Street. Yeah.
Right.
So or Inwood, perhaps they've heard about, but they
Dyckman Farm?
Dyckman Farm.
People have never been there. People have not, you know, they've been to the Cloisters, maybe.
Without realizing that that was a battlefield. And not a happy one for
Sherman
the American
Drake
people.
Arch.
Right.
No one's heard of it. So that was, I mean, for me, that was the discovery. Even though, as I say, I spent time there as a child, and having been a teaching artist and having had a very peripatetic teaching career, I have worked in that neighborhood years ago. But to actually, it was fun to go back. And when I was working on Broadway, I'd like the Sherman Drake Arch. I'd come back and Arch, and I'd come back and I'd read about it and make notes on the back of the drawing about its origins, and that was fabulous. That was really fun, and also, I did that about buildings downtown, some of the cast iron buildings.
Mm-hmm.
I'd find out about who the architects were, and you know, it was what some architect was a hotel architect, and another architect was did a number of the other cast iron buildings, or also find out what had been there before. And so, yeah, there were discoveries in each neighborhood, even though I know Lower Broadway. I've worked in Battery Park City for years mm-hmm. and years and mm-hmm. have walked up those blocks, you know, hundreds of times probably. But, you know, you look up, you notice a lot more. When you draw, you notice even more.
Well, yeah, I think New York, in spite of its running away at as quickly as it can from any kind of historical self-reflection, ends up being quite a repository of history. If you know, right over on Riverside Drive, you've got the Soldiers and Sailors
right.
Monument, which was on land sold to the city by General Dan Sickles, who was a colorful character.
Well, that I didn't
the Battle
know.
Of Gettysburg, lost oh. a leg, and was a scandalous character. The first man to be acquitted for murder on grounds of temporary insanity.
Really?
After he shot the district attorney of Washington, D.C., who was having an affair with his wife. Across the street from the White House.
Wow.
So, you know, colorful history, certainly.
If you're on Broadway, though, and you look at, like 137th Street or so, and your City College is a McDonald's, and it's built on, it's the building, I don't know whether it originated, but at one point that was called the Gotham Theater. And you can see under those red awnings are, you know, chiseled into the stone is the word Gotham Theater. You know, you don't notice that sort of stuff if you don't sit on the street with a chair and look up and draw it. And that's what I did. And that was really, that was the fun part too, was just having to make the choice about which view, because there's a view of every single block. That was the rule. One view per block. And I had to walk around and figure out what it was going to be. Sometimes high up, sometimes low, sometimes mm-hmm. more encompassing, panoramic, other times very zoomed in. So, but there's always some discovery on every block, even like the most mundane kind of apartment building, because of our New York's history of having generations of immigrants who came in, and their influences felt on the buildings. I think that all the architectural sculpture around here is the result of Italian immigration and mm-hmm. people who knew how to cast stone. So, you know, you'd look up in a building that looked like any other building, and there'd be these incredible lion heads, you know, five stories up.
Because you had carvers who understood how to do that.
Yeah, and they came from Italy with those skills and that knowledge, and they needed work.
And also terrazzo floors in the lobbies.
Yeah.
So there's a narrative everywhere if you know where to look for it.
There is, and it's the palimpsest of New York. You know, it's just layers upon layers, and you have to peel off the layers, and you find our history.
It's a wonderful, wonderful word, and perfectly suited to what we're talking about. And it goes back to, I think what you're saying goes back to this idea of the value of drawing and painting as a way of slowing one down and forcing you to actually notice things that if you were out there with a film crew, you perhaps wouldn't see and wouldn't end up becoming part of your work, part of the outcome.
Well, it's a central experience. Right. I mean, it's fine. You know, you're when I was working on Broadway, I'm sitting there, I'm hearing, I'm smelling, I'm tasting. I mean, it's all there.
Interesting you would say that, because there was recently, yesterday, an article in Hyperallergic about the University of Pennsylvania commissioning artists to create soundscapes for photographs of what looked like urban blight. Perhaps they weren't all blight, but the image that was on, you know, the cover at the masthead,
right,
was of Detroit, of that of you know, a demolished house.
Right, I saw
and,
it.
And,
yeah,
and this, of course, we think about Janet Cardiff's 40 motets that was at MoMA, the Cloisters.
Right.
And I hear this more and more from people in the art world, people in the gallery world, that millennials have no interest in hanging paintings on their walls. They're interested in filling the space with some kind of experience. A painting might be part of that, but if that's all it is, if it's just the, you know, the precious object hanging on the wall, that doesn't appeal to them as much. You know, they got a $1 million loft and on IKEA furniture and a closet full of hoodies. They're not really interested in the same kind of conspicuous consumption. This is what I'm hearing from dealers who are like wondering, like, what are they going to be able to sell these people? So when you're talking about the sights, the sounds, the smells, the vibration of the street, I mean, all of this becomes part of the experience of being there. How did you actually kit yourself out? And how did you actually take your practice into the field? Did you have like a camp stool or like a watercolor?
Oh, I have a little rolly cart, as somebody called it, an old lady cart.
And an old lady cart.
An old lady cart. But I got a nice one that's black satin with pink hearts on it.
So it's kind of a wireframe shopping cart. Okay, yeah.
And a portable chair, you know, a nice folding chair with armrests with a nice cup holder.
Spare no expense, no.
$9.99 in the dollar store. And I have a little tiny stool, a little camp stool that would put my palette on there, and I was set to go.
How long would you generally spend on an outing?
It depends on the weather. In the winter, less time. On a really beautiful day, I could spend 5 or 6 hours, and I would do... So what the process was, first a pencil drawing, and then first I'd go to the block that I was due to be on, since I was moving up or downtown, and I would circumnavigate the block to figure out where I was going to set myself up, and then I would draw with pencil for as long as I needed to capture that, and then I would put a coat of watercolor on the paper, or gouache really, more than watercolor. So that would take anywhere from, depending on the complicated, how complicated the image was, anywhere from 20 minutes to, and you know, a couple of hours. And sometimes I would do one block, sometimes two, sometimes three. So multiply that, and that's how long. But again, very weather dependent. If it was cold, I was there less. If it was really hot, I'd be there less. Also, the time of day ranged from, well, I did Times Square at night because I think you had to do Times Square at night. Of course, it's bright enough there to work at night without having any lights. And in the summer, I tried to work early in the morning and late in the afternoon so I wouldn't bake. And in the winter, I worked in the middle of the day so I'd get warm by the sun.
You're talking about painting Times Square at night and also talking about how much you love daylight. Did working under those lights change your sense of color? Did you find that to be challenging?
Well, what I did, actually, the third step after the watercolor, the gouache and the pencil, is I used photographs. So I brought my photographs back here and looked at them on the screen, on the digital photographs. And those photographs are really purple. That's what happens when you photograph in Times Square at night. Everything looks purple. So I actually sort of de-purpled them. You know, I tried to go back to my memory and exaggerate it, actually. Mm-hmm. So you have the brightness of the signs against the blackness of the night.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what are you working on now?
So now I'm working on, well, I think because the Broadway project took exactly 1 year, and that was what it was called, a year on Broadway, which I hadn't planned. But when I started doing it, I realized there were 252 blocks, and I had done 20 blocks in 12 months. And if you multiply 12 times 20, you get 240. And I thought, oh, I could do this in a year. So I liked that. I liked seeing what one can do in 1 year. I liked that kind of format. And being the daughter, I realized that I'm the daughter of an accountant and a political economist. So there's a certain aspect of accountability in every way possible in my work. So there's a numeric quality. Like I counted how many things I drew when I drew everything I owned, and I counted the blocks on Broadway. And so all of a sudden and the Antarctica project became a timeline. That was one of the things, aside from the accordion book, I made a timeline. So this is all to say what I'm doing now is I thought I was going to be drawing 1 year of responding to 1 year of radio headlines or headlines I heard, the first radio headline I heard. Being a radio addict, like many artists are, I like having a sort of background of talk and having a political interest, compulsion. So I started making paintings, small paintings of the first headline I heard on the radio every morning, thinking I was going to do that for 1 year. But since the 1 year ends in the middle of watching the world crumble underneath me, I thought I might as well document the whole thing instead of aborting this process. So
it's an open-ended project.
It's open-ended. Right now I'm saying it's going to go through the first 100 days of the administration, but that could change too. Right now I would find it difficult to do something, although there are other projects in the works that are not politically oriented. It'd be hard for me to not deal with what's happening in the world.
So perhaps you might step away from the daily to the weekly or...
Or continue the daily, but also have some other things going simultaneously. We'll see. Always. I never know.
What other projects are you pondering?
Well, I have this poetry project.
That's right.
That's one. And then there's this possible Bedford Avenue, which we'll see.
Well, that would be circling back to...
To Broadway.
To an old idea that actually was the genesis of the Broadway
idea.
Which
is why I'd like to do it in a way, because it would kind of be nice to do it because it was how this whole thing came about. So it doesn't feel like I'm it's become a shtick. It's actually the origins.
So did you think at all about people like Ed Ruscha and his...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But not until after.
That was an afterthought.
Yeah,
you discovered him after the fact.
Well, I knew about it, but sometimes it just doesn't come up when you get this idea and you think, I'm going to do this. Not that I have any, I don't take any, I don't know about originality. I don't sort of think, I think it's sort of I don't know what it means to be original. I think we just do what we do, and sometimes you hit it and sometimes you don't. But I saw an image of Flaubert's clothing. There's a drawing of all of Flaubert's clothing. And I thought, somebody's copying me. And then I realized it was a 19th century drawing. So,
Well, certain things are just in the wind, I think.
Certain things are in the wind. Absolutely. Absolutely. So I do something and then afterwards I think, oh, yeah. And then people tell me. I actually have a file of, when I do something and people tell me about related things. So
if you do the Bedford Avenue project, would you do it in the same way that you did the Broadway project, which was to start at opposite ends and work to probably the middle,
not.
Or would you start at one end and work?
I think I would probably start at Emmons Avenue and work my way towards Manhattan, because there's not a reason. There was a reason here.
Right. Well, you were here.
I was here, right. And I don't have anything about the middle of that. And I also think, it sort of makes more sense for me to come towards Manhattan.
Mm-hmm. Well, here you are.
Here I am.
So, would it be the same as the Broadway project in the sense of its being a continuous image?
I'm still thinking.
Because the Antarctica pieces, as I remember, was more storyboard-like. It was less sort of...
You mean the timeline? Or the the accordion books?
No, the accordion books.
The accordion books were building to building. So they're window.
Narrative, right. Right.
So I don't know. I have to figure it out. It remains to be seen.
The Broadway book, which is again an accordion book,
right? But it's also a continuous drawing.
Is a continuous drawing from one end of Broadway to the
other. I've shown it, because it's traveled. Right, it's been around the country, and it's shown when it's shown. I had a very good digital image made of it. So there's a full reproduction of it, which it's fabulous quality, and it's flat. So it's not accordion folded when I've shown it in Washington State in Texas.
You probably don't want the book to be traveling, because all of that wear and tear would be.
Right. Yeah, so it's very nice to have this really beautiful reproduction.
So when people see your work, when they come to an exhibition or they encounter your work in whatever venue or environment, what is your hope for them to take away from the experience?
So my work has this quality of being intimate and very large at the same time. Right. And what's really nice is that people sort of dive in at their own point of connection. And everybody connects differently. So, for example, with Broadway, people who had been to New York, when I showed it in Texas and in mm-hmm. Washington, I'd see people who had never been to New York go to the sort of iconic places and say, oh, that must be Times Square. Or people who had been to New York would say, oh, I was there, or I remember that. Or so this kind of personal...
Yeah, well, they're going to know Columbus Circle. They're going to know Times Square. Right. They're going to know Herald Square. They're going to know the
Battery.
But
then they would find, like, oh, my aunt lives here.
Right.
Or, you know, so there was a personal connection. When I drew Everything I Owned, which was also, a very large series of drawings, but its component, you know, there were 13,127 objects. People would, you
Are
know.
They all insured?
Nothing's insured. Yes, people have said I have
waggish.
A great record. I remember I showed it to people, some curators, and they got all excited because they said, look, she's got the Patti Smith box set too. And then, you know, other people would be like, oh, look at that kind of hot sauce. And then, where's your bed? And the kind of seeing it as a kind of language, because there's a certain language quality, I think, to my drawing is also about language.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, finding where their connection, their personal overlap.
We spoke earlier about sort of the debate around 20th century taxonomies of studio art.
Which was the title of my show in 2006, was Taxonomies, when I made paintings and drawings about our tax policies in this country, along with making lists. So that was my show.
But, you know, we're talking about illustration and painting and you know, the difference between illustration and painting. I was wondering if you had ever had other artists sort of perplexed by the fact that you're working in a representational mode, you're drawing from observation, and yet there's a deeply conceptual component to what you're doing.
I don't know if other artists are perplexed by it. I feel like I have a certain advantage in that way, because there's an accessibility to the work,
mm-hmm.
so that people who don't know anything about art, which I'm are interested by it, which I think is great. I don't want to be in a, just a sort of rarefied world. I'm happy to have people who don't know anything about art look at my work and enjoy the fact that they can read it, that they enjoy looking at actual depictions. And at the same time, I have my foot in the conceptual world, which I, and I think that sort of is me. So I feel like it's an advantage for me. And if people don't get it, that's okay. That's the advantage to age.
It's another narrative too. I mean, it gives you a kind of critical traction where I think someone who's just doing sort of a straight landscape painting is not going to get the same kind of consideration, because you think about lists, you think about Ad Reinhardt, you think about, you know, artists who kept lists, artists who Hans Hacke, you know, you think about all sorts of connections you can make to artwork that is deemed conceptual that someone might not associate you with because of your studio practice.
Yeah, no, I feel very fortunate to have, I mean, I have that as a as an advantage to what I do. I'm happy about that. Just thinking about going back to Florian Stettheimer and then another connection. So if you look at those, Florian Stettheimer is at the Met, the Cathedral series. Mm-hmm. Every one of those people are actual people. She didn't paint anybody arbitrarily. They are all real people, those faces. And I don't know if you've seen the Nancy Chun show at Ronald Feldman, but Nancy Chun, have you seen that show?
Not yet, no.
It's been there since September. I finally went last week. So she has this Chicken Little, you know, and her, they're very cartoonish.
Oh, I've read about it, yeah.
And all of the faces in her, there's one wall about when Chicken Little goes to prison, goes to jail. And all of the faces in those, not all of them, but I don't know, a couple hundred of the faces in those paintings are actual people. So she's got the whole political scene of 2015, 16, 14, foreign dignitaries, people in entertainment, they're all in there. So even though it's in this much greater story about Chicken Little, it's that is a show to see, I'll tell you. It, don't miss it. It's got another week.
I like that gallery. I interviewed Ron.
Oh, he's a good man. He's a good man.
He really is. And always doing interesting things.
Don't miss that show.
I won't. Have you any plans to exhibit any of your works anytime soon? I know you had a wonderful write-up in the, you know, the New Yorker last year. Will we be able to see your work somewhere in New York soon, do we hope? Okay. Finger
we'll
raised to lips. So something's in the offing.
Something's in the, yeah, something's
okay,
in
the offing. Okay, well, we will make sure.
Keep your fingers crossed, that's what I'll say. But it does, yeah, I have a good interest right now.
I'll have to uncross them to turn off this machine. Thank you for your time today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This has been a conversation with Elise Engler, whose work can be seen in the exhibition The Times at the Flag Art Foundation, 545 West 25th Street in Manhattan's Chelsea Arts District. The show runs through August 11th, 2017. I'm James McElhenney. Thanks for listening.